17th chapter of the book of Proverbs. Verse 8. Remember verse 7, we talked about the idea of mystery last time. What he says in verse 6 of chapter 17 of the book of Revelation, I saw the woman, and this woman who we've just talked about it now at great length, who represents fallen and apostate religion at the very beginning half of a period called the tribulation. I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus, as there will be great persecution that will take place during the time of the tribulation, both by this apostate church at the front half and by Satan directly through the efforts of the Antichrist and those that serve him, the false prophet, in the second half called the Great Tribulation. During this time, believers will be persecuted. All believers will be persecuted, but in particular, those who come to know Jesus, who are of the household of Israel. And they will come in great numbers. All Israel, the Bible tells us in Romans, will be saved. That is, in great numbers, massive numbers, will come to know Jesus as Messiah. But they will become then the special objects of persecution during that particular time. And so we read that this will lead to carnage and martyrdom. So this woman, this false worldly church, so-called, drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I marveled with great amazement. He was dumbfounded, his slack-jawed, as it were, at the awfulness, the awesomeness, the unbelievability of the kind of destructiveness that will be carried out by this one, called the harlot, or the mother of harlots, and of the abominations of the earth. Verse 7, we saw last time, the angel said to me, why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery, something that's been hidden before, but is now to be revealed. I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast that carries her, which has the seven heads and the ten horns. Understand that here in the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation, we have a unique experience in our study of the book of Revelation, in that here is the only place where we have a specific explanation offered and given for the symbolism that we find, of course, throughout the book of Revelation. Now, the symbolism is not to be taken as mere symbolism. The symbolism stands for historical facts and for historical events. But nevertheless, particularly here in the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation, we have pictures. These are not pretty pictures. They are pretty gruesome pictures, in fact, of all that is going to be carried out at the very end times by those who are the arch enemies of our Lord and who will themselves be the servants of Satan, carrying out his will in the world, whether it's a false apostate church on the one hand, or it is this world emperor called the Antichrist and those who forward his cause, the false prophet and others who forward his cause. I have not seen the latest Star Wars epic. Some have and tell me it's quite a feat in terms of special effects and all of that. But one of the things that I remember from having seen an earlier episode or two was the fact that there is an evil emperor over the dark side. And this evil emperor becomes more evil as time goes by. I suppose that we have here one who could be called the evil emperor, the evil king. In fact, earlier in the book of Revelation, he's called the king over the abyss. And that's the one who rules the forces of evil and the forces of darkness could indeed be called the emperor of darkness. Much more malevolent, much more powerful even than the one portrayed for us in the Star Wars epic. But the description that's given to us is, as with other symbolic descriptions, something that puzzles us. As the king says in The King and I, it is a puzzlement. What in the world does this mean? Well, we're going to be told what in the world this means, because we have a beast, and the word beast itself, which means an animal that is does not have a soul, as humans have souls. Oftentimes, I don't want to get into the byway, but will there be animals in heaven? Well, there may be some specific cats and some specific dogs that will make it. I don't know. I'm not going to hypothesize, but we once buried an animal with great pomp and circumstance, and there were assurances given that if any animal ever would make it, this one would make it. But be that as it may, we're also told that there will be a time at the end of the age when there will be, if you will, a Pacific condition. Not West Coast Pacific, but Pacific in the sense of quiet and peaceful condition that will obtain in the animal kingdom as the lion will lie down with the lamb. Some of you have seen, of course, pictures that portray that. The idea is that the natural brutality of beasts, the instinctive brutality of beasts, if you've taken a dog out for a walk and you go by a squirrel or a cat, there is an instinctive kind of lunge that takes place without a lot of forethought that goes on. The muscles tense and the animal is prepared to leap, and were it not on a leash, there would be one less beast alive in the world. So, or more than one. So we know that the whole portrayal of beasts in the Bible, in the Old Testament and the New Testament, is of an unthinking creature. Now, we know that animals are conscious. We know that animals have feelings. We know that there are analogs, if you will, in terms of the emotions of animals with the emotions of human beings. We can say that animals both are anxious and fearful and loving and kind in some ways, and can also be very vicious in others. Paul says on one occasion, beginning in the Old Testament, it says that human beings are in one way no superior to the beasts, in that we all perish. That is to say, we all have a death sentence awaiting us. It is appointed, the Bible says, unto man and beasts once to die. That death physically awaits all natural creatures in this world, whether animal or human or plant or any other creature in this world. Death is a sure thing, even surer than taxes, as sure as those may seem to be. In the New Testament, the Apostle Paul said on one occasion, he said, why am I here being criticized if I have fought, he says, with brute beasts in Ephesus? Now that was a metaphor to describe, in Paul's case, the vicious kind of enemies that he had there in Ephesus. The ones, you remember, who gathered in that large crowd of 25,000 and were ready to tear him and all of his followers apart there in the city of Ephesus. I remember when we visited Ephesus, on one of the two occasions I've had to go to the Bible part of the world. And I remember Dr. Graham and I were walking by, and there was a guide, a Turkish guide, because, of course, Ephesus is in Turkey, who was hurrying us along past the stadium. We were not going to get to go in the stadium. Oh, we have more things to see. As it turned out, there was this spiel to buy rugs at the end that was really waiting for us, and that was not made clear. But I said to Jack, I said, we can't do this. We can't go by the place where Paul was put on the spot, where others were put on the spot. And so we used our whatever little authority we had to stop the whole thing. Said, wait, we're going to go in. And so we went in, and this is a stadium that's still used today. And as I thought about this passage of Scripture, because Paul says, if after, you know, I have, after the manner of human beings, I have fought with wild beasts in Ephesus. I've paid my dues. And I've paid my dues with enemies that are implacable, that know no mercy and show no quarter. And that was the image that he was trying to convey in that particular instance. And then, of course, even in the book of Jude, the last book just before the book of Revelation, we read in the book of Jude, the half-brother of the Lord, in verse 10, referring, in fact, to people who are, shall we say, false believers, false professors of faith, who certainly were not living as they ought to live if they were true believers, how they were willing to shoot off at the mouth and say things that they had no right to say. But then he says in verse 10, but these folks speak evil of whatever they do not know, and whatever they know naturally, like brute beasts, in these things they corrupt themselves. Animals seem to not worry about being neat. They wallow in the blood. They tear things apart, and or they are torn apart, and there's no neatness about it. And so it is that these people were not exactly careful. They shot off at the mouth without much restraint, not knowing where the wreckage would lie afterward. And sometimes we ourselves have been known to be loose at the mouth in terms of saying things we ought not to say. And what he's comparing this to is the wild and wanton and unrestrained behavior of wild beasts. So here we have these pictures given to us of wild animals in particular, domestic animals, I'm not going to say anything negative at this point about domestic. But wild animals certainly are portrayed as those brute beasts who have no minds in the sense of have no conscience. And likewise it is with Satan. When Satan destroys and wrecks individual lives and families and churches and nations, there's no conscience. He is truly a brute beast. And so it is absolutely apropos that Satan should be called a beast. And of course, not only is Satan called a beast, we know that from the 13th chapter of the book of Revelation, the beast from the sea is a portrayal of Antichrist. And that's the beast that we're talking about in this chapter, is Antichrist, the world evil emperor. But also the word beast is used for the false prophet, the beast from the earth. And even the beast is referred to as an image of the empire of the false prophet. This will be, of course, the Babylon at the end of the age. So here we have the word beast applied to each of these personages and or these organizations or these entities. Referring to the fact that they have no conscience, that they are vicious, that they show no quarter. We have an enemy that can truly be likened to a lion, which is a wild beast, as Peter does, of course, in his letter. We're not dealing with a civilized being. We're not dealing with a being with conscience. And so it is at the end of the age. There will be no nicety as far as, you know, due process is concerned. We think that some emperors in times past have been peremptory and abrupt and have been arbitrary and capricious in the way they have carried out their pogroms and their vicious attacks upon peoples. But that will be nothing as compared with the conscienceless, brutal, beast-like behavior that will be evidenced during the time called the Tribulation and the Great Tribulation. Enough about beasts. This is a beast that carries the woman. There is common cause in the first half of the tribulation period between false religion, on the one hand, which will act, if you will, as a front, as a, if you will, some sort of representation of something of greater value than simply the overweening personal ambitions of Satan and the Antichrist. This is supposed to represent something of value, presumably. Well, the value is, of course, Satan's own desire to be worshipped. And the value is, of course, the Antichrist's desire, like his masters, to be worshipped. That's the value. But this is represented as a church, this false church. Well, this is a state church. This is an empire church. Constantine may or may not have done Christianity a favor when, in the 4th century, he declared the Roman Empire to be Christian and marched his soldiers down into the river to be baptized. They were pagans one moment and they were Christians the next by fiat, by emperor fiat. That's not how you become a Christian. Not by the sword and not by emperor's orders does that happen. But this will be a state church. This will be an empire church. This will be the front door, the front window, if you will, that is respectable, quote unquote, of the Antichrist in the world at that particular time. So the beast, which represents Satan and the Antichrist and the false prophet, will support in the first half of the tribulation period, will support religion. It'll support this eclectic religion, this worldwide religion that is referred to here as the harlot. It will also support the renewal of the practices of the Jewish people in Jerusalem, the renewal of animal sacrifice and the other ceremonial observances in Jerusalem, as there is a concordat that will be established between the Antichrist and the Jewish people, supposedly to champion their cause and to make peace with them. But we know that in the middle of this 7-year period, there's going to be a sudden turncoat situation occur. That is, the Antichrist will suddenly turn on the world church and will suddenly turn on Israel. In both instances, we're going to see all pretense go away. We're going to see all religiosity that is not directed specifically at the worship of Satan and at the worship of the Antichrist. We're going to see all that go away. That there will be an image of the Antichrist that will be planted firmly in the temple. The image that will the false prophet will enforce people to worship will have an interactive quality. It will speak. It will be a return to idolatry and a return to the one goal that Satan has had from the very, very beginning, which is to be worshipped as God. That's his program. And that's the goal of the Antichrist at this particular time. This beast, Satan, the Antichrist, the false prophet, will support this world religion at the beginning. And that's why it says that the harlot is carried by the beast. Verse 8. The end of verse 7, we'll get back to this, says that the beast that carries her, that is the political system that is this world empire, led by the Antichrist that carries her, will have 7 heads and 10 horns. And like other images, that's a bit bizarre, of course. It's not something common. We think of it as mythological almost, to think of beasts that have multiple heads and that sort of thing. And yet we know that there is an explanation. In fact, there are 2 explanations for the number 7 that are given here in the terms of the 7 heads. And another explanation is given to us of the 10 as well. So here's the one place, as we said, in the book of Revelation where an explanation is actually offered for the symbolism. Verse 8. The beast that you saw and is not. Excuse me. The beast that you saw was and is not, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit and go to perdition. There is as compact a description of the history of the Antichrist as you're going to find in any one sentence anywhere in the Scriptures. First of all, what is the reference here at the beginning of verse 8? The beast that you saw was and is not and will ascend. Now remember, John's writing this well in advance of the appearance of this new evil emperor that will come to place at the end of the age. So we're not talking about something that really existed in his own day, though there are many preterists and those who try to equate all the stuff that's written in Revelation with what was going on in the first century, who had identified this with Nero and try to say that it only had to do with a line of Roman emperors. But nobody's ever been able to make a neat list of exactly the 7 Roman emperors involved, and they kind of twist and turn to try to make it fit, and it doesn't. The beast that you saw was and is not and will ascend out of the bottomless pit. Now, there actually were several rumors in the first century after the suicide of Emperor Nero. Rumors that he would come back to life and that he would bring armies from the east and march back to Rome and retake his throne. Of course, that never occurred, even though there were rebels who erupted over time and who said that they were the revived Nero, bringing him back to life. So there was that kind of mythology about the Emperor Nero. But this beast that you saw was, that is, existed at one point, and is not, ceases to exist at one point, and 3, will ascend out of the bottomless pit, that is, will come back to life, to oppose, of course, the things of the Lord, and to organize the world into the final battle that is described, but who will then ultimately and finally go to perdition. And the word for perdition is the same word as the word used for hell. Exactly the same word. In fact, we need to understand that the gospel in a nutshell, that is, of course, John 3:16, contains the same word that we use for perdition. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish. And the word for perish is the verb form that is the same as the noun form here for perdition, the place of perishing. And perishing here means final destruction, not a temporary short-term or short-lived destruction, but the ultimate destruction that is hell itself. And so the last hurrah, the epitaph, if you will, for the evil emperor, for the beast, that is, of course, this Antichrist, the one who pretends to take the place of Jesus, but is actually opposed to Jesus. The ultimate story is that this beast perishes. What's interesting is that both, we're going to see this as we go on in Revelation, that both the Antichrist and the false prophet perish before Satan does, in the sense of being cast into the lake of fire first. We're going to see that. So his last hurrah is going to be even shorter lived than Satan's. Having said that, let's look back at the 13th chapter of the book of Revelation, where we see an event described that relates to these verbs, was, is not, and will come back. Chapter 13 of the book of Revelation. First, the beast out of the sea, which refers to the Antichrist. Notice the same description is given to us as we just have read. appear in the book of Revelation in chapter 17. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, same description, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his horns 10 crowns. Of course, that refers to authority or kingship, and on his heads a blasphemous name. The heads, if they are as I believe they are, representative of worldwide empires in succession that have had sway over most of the civilized world over history. Each of these, of course, has been champions. Each of these world empires have been champions of false gods. And the blasphemous names are the names of the false gods, the idols that were worshipped by each of these successive world empires. And there's a description of this which is not unlike the description you find in the Old Testament of the beast. But let's move on to verse 3. Of chapter 13 of Revelation. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded. And his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast. There is going to be some kind of event. Do you remember, if those of you have read Shakespeare, the kind of dramatic encounter between Brutus and Cassius and Caesar, where the senators who are in this conspiracy all surround Caesar and proceed to dispatch him. And the line in Shakespeare is, "Et tu, Brute," not you, not my friend, not you too, Brutus, Caesar says in the play. We're going to have some kind of assassination attempt. More than an attempt, it will appear to be successful. But notice the word that we read. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded. And his deadly wound was healed. Now there's a debate among scholars as to whether or not the death is a real death or only an apparent one. Whether there is some kind of a flim-flam deal that's going to go on where special effects will be used and it'll appear that he's dead. And so that when he comes back to life, it'll appear that there's a resurrection. All of these things are open for debate, but suffice it to say, I think it is possible that it will be flim-flam. It is possible that it will be a pretend death, which is carried out with such great skill that for all intents and purposes, the world, you know, the doctors will come along and they'll do the normal kind of, I don't know if it'll be an autopsy or not, but they'll do the kind of inspection that will verify that this one is indeed dead, so that everybody says, you know, the leader of the world empire has been assassinated. Banner headlines across all the newspapers of the world at that particular time. That he is going to be placed in a tomb of some sort, as if he's being buried. And then he is going to come to life again. The wound that dispatched him will suddenly be healed. The death will be reversed. And the coming back to life again will be a mirroring, an attempt to mirror or imitate the resurrection of Jesus Christ. This is why the Antichrist is going through events that copy, if you will, in certain ways what happened with Jesus, so that people will believe, well, this must be the Messiah. I mean, this must be the real deal, because after all, the same sorts of things are happening. They won't stop to think, and because many of them will not be well informed and they will be unbelievers, but they will not stop to think that this event that is the event that was the event of Jesus was once for all, not to be repeated. And then for this to be described as a repetition will itself be a contradiction in terms of the once-for-all event that was to have taken place and that did take place. Yes? Pardon? I believe you're jumping ahead here, but I believe that the city that is called Babylon here, and the description of Babylon is given to us in chapter 17 of the book of Revelation. At the very end, when it describes the woman, the false religion, and the woman whom you saw is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. There have been very few cities, single cities, that have individually had control over the whole civilized world, Rome being perhaps the last great city to have that kind of control. And the fact that you're going to have a succession to the Roman Empire, what really could be called a reviving of the Roman Empire, occur, means that the imagery here probably very well fits the evil empire. I remember that I was actually present at the time when Ronald Reagan gave the evil empire speech. And I was at that meeting. And my kids were even closer than I was. They got up in the front row and they reported to me some of the nasty things that Sam Donaldson said during the Well, that's an aside. During the Evil Empire speech, but they were there and took pictures of Reagan as he gave this particular speech. But I remember what a moving description, in the sense of captivating description, this was of the Communist Empire. The Evil Empire. That was a small evil empire by comparison with the worldwide reach of this evil empire, which will not only cover a part of the world, but will reach out to the entire world. And it's described as this great city that has sway over all the kings of the earth. Some have argued that it's not simply the city of Rome at large, although some have argued that it is the city of Rome at large. But the religious aspect of the city of Rome, of course, is Vatican City, which is another city that has sway in the religious sense over the entire world for those who are in that particular communion. And so it is often argued that it is Rome, generally speaking, and perhaps the Vatican City, particularly speaking. Dave Hunt has a book which makes that case very strongly, which is referred to here. I am probably going to argue that we don't have a specific duplication or continuation of the Catholic Church as such. Number one, it will not be exclusively Christian. It will be eclectic. On the other hand, there are precedents, that is, bits of other religions will be mixed in. Paganism will be mixed in. And so that's already the case, and perhaps one might argue, in a number of respects, but this will be openly and overtly the case. So while it may be in the place of where the Vatican City is or where Rome is today, it will not be, in my mind, necessarily a neat and unbroken continuation of that particular communion. I think it will be a mother mockery or imitation of a worldwide church, but it will be one that will be controlled by Satan. And it will likely be located in Rome. Some have argued that the political empire that will be the empire of the Antichrist is actually presaged or is anticipated by the European Union. That you have this confederation of nations within Europe that will perhaps locate their ultimate operational headquarters in Rome. Well, they have other locations now where business is being done, in Brussels and elsewhere. But the issue is, will this indeed be the final capital of the European Union? And is the European Union, if you will, the empire that initially the Antichrist will head before the assassination attempt and later be replaced by his own permanent kingdom after he is miraculously raised from the dead? But I want you to look with me now back at the 13th chapter of the book of Revelation. We've already seen the one reference in verse 3 that this beast is apparently killed as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world marveled and followed the beast. Now go down further in the book of Revelation chapter 13 to verse 12, and we're describing the activity of the false prophet who is the high priest of the beast. And in verse 12 we read, "And he exercises all the authority of the first beast." So the false prophet is himself called a beast. "Exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence and causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed." Whose deadly wound was healed. He performs great signs. Going back now to the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation. The beast you saw was, exists at one point, initially as the leadership, as the leader of this empire, is not, perishes, apparently perishes, as a result of the assassination attempt, is miraculously brought back to life again, comes out of the abyss. We have already seen earlier the description of the locusts that came out of the abyss, which refers to demons being released from a place of abode, if you will, of Satan. Let's make one thing very clear, that the pit, as it's called, or the bottomless pit, as it's called, is not the same thing as hell. Very important that you realize that. That if there is an underground, deep, recessed location, a headquarters central, if you will, for Satan and the demons, and it is called the pit, or it is called the bottomless pit, it is not the same thing as hell. Hell is not a place where Satan sets up shop and runs the joint. You know, as in all the cartoons where you have the demons in their red suits stoking the furnace for the souls of those who are lost. No, hell is the lake of fire into which Satan will be put, along with the false prophet, along with the Antichrist, along with all those whose names are not written in the Lamb's Book of Life. It is not a place where he will be in charge, it will be a place where he will be punished forever and forever. That is hell. But this is a location that is a location for activity. It is a headquarters location. It is called the pit. It is called, and the one who is the ruler over this place is called Apollyon. And so Satan is the master, the king, if you will, over this domain, this evil domain. If you want to see another description of this, just go to any of the old pagan literatures and you'll see it. For example, you read in Plato. Plato has a dialogue called the Phaedo, Phaedo, in case you want to look this up. In the Phaedo, Plato describes the nether world. And he has it complete with purgatory. He has people who you know, get better and better over time as a result of going through the purgatory experiences. They go through the rivers underground and they... Reward is, heaven is getting back to the surface. That's heaven, getting back to the surface of this planet. Well, that's how the myth goes. The lowest place in the nether world, which we would call the pit, the bottomless pit, is reserved for those incorrigibles, as Plato would have it, for whom the purgatory will do no good. These are the bad dudes. And they're there permanently. They're not going to get out for good behavior because there won't be any, and they won't have any chances to get out. And so they're consigned and they're assigned to this lowest level of the underground or the nether world. All the pagan religions have an underground or nether world. It's a dark place. It's a place of shadows. You know, read Homer, the poetry of Homer, when he describes the afterworld where some of the great heroes like Achilles are placed after their deaths. And Achilles is made to say by Homer in his epic, it is better to be a live dog in the world than to be a dead Achilles in this place. What's the good of being a hero? What's the good of having been a great one when here you're the same as all the other shades? And so always it's a dark place, a shadowy place, a place of inactivity, a place of foreboding, a place where there's very little going on except suffering. Of one sort, of one degree or another. Not a charming place at all. Yes? In my mind, there could be. I'm hesitant to say, to identify them absolutely, but there could be. The reason I say this is, if Hades is the waiting, what I call the waiting place of those who are outside of God, the Lord himself gives a description of such a place. Do you remember the example that the Lord gave of the rich man and Lazarus? That the rich man is in Hades. He is in a place of punishment. Or at least it's not a place of punishment so much as it is a place of suffering. I think there's a distinction to be made. It isn't that Satan is there punishing him. It is rather that he is going through torment. He says, I'm in this place of torment. In the description that the Lord gives of where the rich man is after his death. But it is not hell, not finally. And in fact, there will be a resurrection of those who were lost as well at the very end of the age, who will then come before the great white throne, who will be judged, and who will be consigned to hell itself. If there is a waiting place for those who are not God's people, it could be called Hades. And if there's a waiting place, a place of suffering, a place of foreboding, along the lines of the pagan descriptions that we've talked about, it could very well be identified with this bottomless pit, this underground area that is described as the abode of the evil one. So I think it's a possible identification, but I don't have enough, shall we say, knowledge to make it an absolutely dogmatic identification. Possible. The beast you saw existed at one point. The assassination attempt appears to be successful and is not, and will ascend out of the bottomless pit, out of this abode, and go to perdition. Ultimately, there'll be some things going on in the middle, obviously. Perdition referring to hell. And those who dwell on the earth will marvel. We saw that already in chapter 13. When the beast comes alive again. There is a, you know, the jaw-dropping, agape kind of experience. Wow! And of course, all the television cameras will be turned on, and they'll see the corpse quiver, and this finger move, and twitch here, and next thing you know, the Frankenstein, you know, with much more vivacity than that, no doubt, coming alive. Wow! This is the place to worship. This is where the real power is, man. They will marvel. Who's going to do the marveling? Who's going to do the wowing. It says the people that will be impressed will be the lost. The people who will be impressed will be the lost. Those whose names are not written in the book of life from the foundation of the world. I'm tempted into an aside. And I've been known to yield to such temptations in the past. Some call them rabbit trails. I call them interesting points to be explored. But the Lamb's Book of Life, or the Book of Life, which is referred to throughout the Bible, suggests that God knows from the very beginning those who are His. We know it's a finite number, according to the Bible. We know that it is the minority of all human beings that have ever lived. Why do I say a minority? Jesus himself said, what? That the way to eternal life is a narrow way, and few there be that find it. A minority. We will never be in the majority, although in the day of this false religion, it will appear that Satan finally achieves his goal of having everybody, at least those whose names are not written in the book of life, fall down and worship him. They'll be the ones who'll be impressed. They'll be the ones who will follow him. They'll be the ones who will become his armies and pursue his goals at that particular time. Those whose names are not written in the book of life. Now, I've given more extensive explanations of this in the past, but let me give you a more modest one. Now, time-wise modest. We'll see if it's modest time-wise after we're finished. But God, and the Bible makes this clear in a number of ways, God is outside of time. That's a very important concept. One of the great issues theologically in people's minds is the issue of predestination and foreknowledge. And how does God in his sovereignty determine those who are to be saved? I remember hearing Pastor Graham say on one occasion, you know, heaven, because of our limited knowledge, the gate to heaven says on one side, as you enter, whosoever will. And then once you're on the inside and you look back, you know that that only the elect are saved. Elect means chosen. Elect means selected. Throughout the Bible, the Bible makes it clear that God is not into universalism. There's a universalist religion and religions which say everyone's going to be saved. God couldn't be a hard-hearted spoil sport. He couldn't hold people accountable for their decisions. He couldn't hold people, or wouldn't hold people accountable for their rejection of him and of his forgiveness. He wouldn't do any of those things to be mean. So he's going to ultimately save everybody. There's nothing in the Bible that gives us that hope. Because, you know, if we ever were convinced that one day everyone's going to be saved, no matter what they do here and now, whether they accept Jesus or not, why bother to share the gospel and go to all the trouble that we go to share the gospel if they're going to make it anyway? No, the Bible nowhere gives us that hope. But what it does say is that God knows those who are his, and he knows the end from the beginning. It also says that he's outside of time in another way, and that is his name. His name is I Am Who I Am, Yahweh. I Am Who I Am. God, because he's outside of time, does not have a past. God, because he's outside of time, does not have a future. The Bible's description of God is of a being who has an eternal present. William James, the psychologist, philosopher of the 19th century, once did an experiment to try to measure how long the present is. He did, and he timed it. He said, the present is determined by how long you can hold within your gaze and your attention span any given experience. That's the length of the present. And so, right now, I'm looking at a sea of faces, of wonderful faces in this room, and I have you within my gaze. And William James, in his experiment, timed it. 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, about 3 seconds. Now it's a memory. What I saw, the snapshot I saw, is a memory. It's past. It's no longer present. The present, he called the present the knife-edge present, because it's so narrow. As far as what we hold within our attention span. God, if you will, according to the Bible, is not only outside of time, he's not only a being whose experience is an eternal present, but unlike William James' knife-edge present, God's present is eternally wide. Now, the ancient Greek philosophers known as the Eleatics, talked about the world being unchanging. But they had this frozen world, you know, where arrows didn't fly and Achilles didn't win the race and other things like that. Nothing moves. But God is not only eternal, not only is his present, everything that's before him and is in his attention span, not only is it eternally wide, so nothing becomes past to him, ever. But he's dynamic, not frozen. He interacts with people and with his creatures, and there is movement in the sense of interaction, but he doesn't change. Jesus Christ the same, yesterday, today, and forever. You and I change. That's why we have a past, present, and future. Time is the measure of change. Let me repeat. Time is the measure of change. If you have no change, you have no time. God does not change. Logic says, therefore, God is outside of time. Now, for him, the end and the beginning are words that apply to us. See, we look down the road at the future, and we look backward at the past, because we're in time. We change. The world changes. And so we say, well, here's God back here, and he looks down the road, and he sees what's going to happen 20 centuries from now, and he sees the awful things. Why doesn't he stop it? Why doesn't he arrange for it to be stopped 20 centuries? Well, God doesn't look down the road. He doesn't have a down the road. He only has a present. We have a down the road because we're in time. We look down the road at the future, and we look back at the past. But God has everything in front of him. If you will, it's all done. It's complete from his perspective, but not frozen, because we are real. Our experiences are real. The changes in our experience are also real, but they don't change him. And so when he says to us, well, whom I have foreknown, he's accommodating our language. He's accommodating our experience. You time-bound creatures think in terms of a past, present, and future. Well, let me cast it in your terms. If I were a being in time, I would know ahead of time those who are my own. I would foreknow them. If I were a being in time, I would have a plan for those creatures down the road. I would predestine what they were going to do down the road a piece. But he doesn't have to develop plans for creatures down the road a piece. He doesn't have to anticipate events down the road a piece. There isn't a down a road a piece for God. It's all present with him, with whom we have to do. Why am I telling you this? Because, if you will, those who are his, he knows eternally. Not new, not will know, but knows eternally. All those who are his, we say from eternity past to eternity future. That's an accommodation to our language as well. Eternity doesn't have a past or a future, only has a present. But he knows eternally those who are his. Therefore, those who are in the Lamb's Book of Life, from our perspective, have always been in the Lamb's Book of Life. But that's only as we try to accommodate our time-bound experience to the eternal experience of God. We can't cross that divide. Time-bound creatures can never and will never know what it is like to be a timeless being like God. That's why those in today's New Age movement who want us to become gods, unfortunately, are unable to capture the uniqueness of God's experience. They make the God's experiences sort of like human experiences, only writ large. All the pagan gods were human beings, writ large, with all the foibles and failings that we have. But God says, I'm not a man. I do not change. I'm not fickle. I don't say yesterday and no tomorrow. God is constant and consistent and the same yesterday, today, and the rest. But he is alive and he is dynamic and he interacts with us creatures in time. But eternally he knows those who are his. See, now, we don't have that privilege. Only he does know those who are his. Only he knows who are in the Lamb's Book of Life. We don't. And so I say to you, I think I'll check page 5,047 to see if you're in the book, because if you're in the book, I'll talk to you about Jesus. If you're not, I'm going to say, it's no point in bothering. You're not there. We don't have that privilege. We have a command. Go into all the world. Make disciples of every nation. Preach the gospel to all human beings. Because we don't know those who will respond. Will is a time-bound term. Those who, in the real experience of human beings, one day will respond. I writ my own dad off as unreachable at one point in my life.
because he was such a tough nut. Tried to witness to him. I brought him to a Billy Graham meeting, and he said he's a terrible speaker. That was a tough experience. Tried really hard. Prayed really hard. Gave up. And years later, he moved to another state, married a lady who was a Christian who got on his case. Somebody came door to door, knocked on the door, and asked him to receive Christ, and he did. What a wise person I am. Dumb. Not to know that the things that are in God's control and his sovereign care will transpire because he knows the end from the beginning. He knows those who are his. And even though he was still rough around the edges after he became a Christian, he became a Christian in the good grace of God. I wish I could wave a wand and say, I will make every human being that's ever lived in the universe a Christian just like that. Ain't gonna happen. Why? Because the Bible also says there's another fact. And the other fact is that we human beings, I said it would take a minute or two, but I was wrong. There is another fact about us human beings, and that is that we are stubborn, willful,